rather heavily on the last part of last week's class, where we read through the first part of chapter 7, saw it in those first 14 verses, then the vision itself. Daniel, of course, in the night is dreaming, and in this dream he sees this terrifying, unsettling vision. I wasn't able to identify the painter there, but it looks familiar to me from a man named Doré, I believe from the 1800s, so possibly his, but actually I had never seen that before, found that just today, one of the better representations, I think, of these beasts that are coming up out of the sea as a result of the winds, the four winds of heaven, churning up that sea. So what we have seen last week in Daniel chapter 6 and verse 4, you go down and scan through that material again, but in chapter 6 and in verse 4, there is a lion with wings like an eagle. They are plucked. The lion is lifted up. It stands up on 2 feet like a man, and a human mind is given to it. This is followed by an animal that is also recognizable, a bear that comes up out of this churned up water, has 3 ribs in its mouth, and of course is raised up somehow on one side, but it's not described what that means, it's just stated, and so everyone wonders, you know, it's exactly how that bear looked. Then we have verse 5, a leopard, again, a readily identifiable animal, though odd, of course, in that it has both 4 heads and then 4 wings. This is followed in Daniel 6 and verse 7 by a monster. So we have a beast now that is not recognizable. It is altogether different. It's terribly distressing to Daniel. Let's go ahead and read in verse 7. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. It had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed, trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So this thing is apparently bloody and vicious and violent, and it's distressing, it's disturbing for Daniel. Verse 8, he's thinking about these 10 horns, and then another horn, a little one, came up among them. 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it, and behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. Then we have 9 and 10. They keep looking, throne set up, Ancient of Days took his seat, vesture like white snow, hair like pure wool, throne ablaze with flames, wheels of burning fire, and in 10, a river of fire flowing and coming out from before him, thousands upon thousands attending, and a significantly larger number, myriads upon myriads, that were standing before him, apparently to receive orders or being servants somehow as well, but not directly involved in attending to him. And then in 10, the court sat and the books were open. In 11 and 12, he keeps looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. Kept looking until the beast was slain. So that's the larger creature, the monster, of which this is just but one horn upon the head of that monster, but its body is destroyed, given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. Verses 13 and 14 now, almost as if Daniel had been distracted again by these 10 horns, and particularly the 11th, the little one that grows up and boasts great things, we come back to this judgment again. In verse 13, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples and nations, men of every language, might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Now let me just pause to comment. You might want to make the list right here, as I've done in my Bible. We were every week almost. I've been trying to make this point. Hold on just a second there, Jimmy. In verse 14 at the end, please write down Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, chapter 4, verses 3 and 34, chapter 6, verse 26, and upcoming in chapter 7 is verse 27. In all of those locations, which of course is five locations now, we're told about this dominion, this everlasting kingdom, this great power. So I'm sorry, Jimmy, I held you out there. Okay. Sorry, thank you. Donna caught something here a week or two. We had to go home and work on charts, too. So I appreciate that. Yeah, you're right. I am. And my fault entirely. So sorry about that one. But we'll try to get that fixed for the next time. So then, we finally come to verses 15 through 28, which I just want to read on through. This will be our interpretation. I wanted you to see it last week, see it again this week, just now, and do it a third time so that we can try to start juggling all these component parts. So look at verse 15. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me. The visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. These great beasts, which are four kings which will arise from the earth. What did we see them coming out of? The sea. Now that sea is identified as the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and of the ten horns that were on its head, and the other which came up, and before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. That's kind of strange and funny. You know, it's a little horn, and then it's bigger than all the rest, because it starts out small, and then it grows up. Now 21, I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. Please take note, by way of my first comment, to try to help you understand all of this. Where is this kingdom? It's on the earth. So in 23, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from the other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth, tread it down, and crush it. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, ten kings will arise, and another will arise after them. He'll be different from the previous ones and will subdue three kings. He'll speak out against the Most High, wear down the saints of the highest one, will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they'll be given into his hand for times, times, and half a time. Will this be up in heaven or down on earth? Be down on earth. But the court will sit, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Most High One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom in all the dominions which are still there, and they were on the earth. They'll still be there, but all these dominions will serve and obey him. 28. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me. My face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself, save for the writing of this chapter that gives us this fascinating story. Now, we have to go really, 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 really fast. So again, I'm leaning on your recognition of what happened in Daniel chapter 2. In Daniel 2, who had the dream?
Daniel.
Nebuchadnezzar. In Daniel 2, and I realize there's a couple ways to number, but effectively, how many component parts do we have? Big parts. It's five. There's four in the statue, four parts in the statue, and then the fifth one is what? The stone is cut out without hands, comes down, crushes all four of these. They are integrated, and they are all of them being destroyed at the same time. Well, we know what that is. That's a chart I spent a lot of time constructing out of somebody else's material, but fixed it so I could reveal it as I am about to do. But this chart is designed to show you similarities between Daniel chapter 2, chapter 7, and chapter 8. You remember 2? We just read 7. Kind of once and a half now, thanks to last week. We'll be coming up on 8 next week. Now look at this. What is the head of gold? It's Babylon. There's no doubt about it. What is the breast and the arms of silver? It's Medo-Persia. What are the belly and the hips or the thighs of bronze? That's Greece. What are the legs of iron and feet that have a mixture of clay that is identified not as a kingdom 4A and 4B, but just as a single fourth kingdom, that one kingdom? What is it? It's Rome. And there's absolutely no debate about it, brethren, among Christians. Now, the Baptists may argue about it. Pentecostal people may argue about it. Catholics are arguing with the Lutherans about it. But, in my opinion, for serious Bible students and Christians, this is a piece of cake. Simple as can be. Daniel chapter 2. What do we see in Daniel 7? A lion with wings. What do you suppose it just might represent? It's Babylon, beyond all doubt. By the way, I didn't point this out last week. So, a couple of weeks ago, we were doing chapter 2. I think I was pointing out how big that Babylon was, and I showed you some pictures and whatnot. It was one of the common motifs for the Babylonian Empire is a lion with wings. Now, I don't know how much to make out of that, but it is a fact that this is Babylon, for sure. And then we have this bear. What does the bear represent? Medo-Persia, just like the chest represented in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Then we've got this four-headed leopard with four wings. What would it represent? It represents Greece. And finally, what do we have? This monstrous beast, which, again, just like the legs and feet, represents Rome. And brother, really, there's just no doubt about that. Once again, among Christians, there's no debate, there's no discussion, there's no concern. We know that's what it is because we verified it 100 different ways in our Bible studies. That's what that is talking about in chapter 7. Now, I don't have to elaborate upon, but that's what it's talking about. You'll see why in just a minute. Now, just wanted to add, though, notice how they brought this yellow up like this. And they came across with this gray. And so in chapter 8, next week, we're going to only have two component parts of another vision. This time, though, they are named in the passage. And so what are they? Medo-Persia and Greece. Now, we're going to deal with that in great detail. We get over here, and we'll be talking again about four heads and four wings and all of that when we get down to this goat again next week. But I just gave you the preview. There is absolutely no debate among Christians that these three chapters are talking about physical kingdoms beginning with Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon going successively down through time, all verifiable in history. Every point of what we're told in the vision matches what takes place historically in the centuries that lay ahead of Daniel that now lie behind us. So we're going to be looking in three different places in Daniel at all this history under figures of strange things. We're actually going to be looking at a fourth time and in far greater detail when we get to chapter 11. Did everybody get one of these when you came in? It's an outline of chapter 11. We're not going to discuss 11, until we get there in time, but this will be very important to you tonight, so make sure you got one of those. Dean will be out in the hall. If you didn't, you can go ahead and ask him for that. So, what do we have? what we have in Daniel, that should be 7, in Daniel chapter 7, verses 2 through 15, is this, a terrifying vision of creatures coming out of the sea, three of which have varying body parts of recognizable animals that have been mixed and matched. And then we've got this monster with 10 horns, and a little horn, 11th, that comes up little, gets big, and tears out three. That's the picture. Now, the reason I'm going so fast, and the reason why you'll probably be a little bit frustrated when the class gets over, is just this, though, brethren. I counted, and it's hard to count. I did it more than once, and I scratched my head, and I think, well, how many different things can you read about in chapter 7 that are part of the vision and we would hope would be explained, interpreted, revealed? There are, by my count, 60 parts. When you read and putting together, you know, chapter 7, there's 60 different things to be interpreted. Three times you got this number 4. What is that? Then you got, you know, beast, and what do the wings represent, and what do the ribs represent, and why this, and why that, and why the other, iron teeth, you know, on and on you go. I count 60. What's frustrating is that when you start in verse 15, Daniel says, I want to know what that's talking about. I can identify only 8 out of the 60 that we're actually told this means that. Okay? And so, you know, and the first temptation, I guess, is to go home and go to bed like Daniel did. Exhausted and confused. Brother, it's not going to be so hard. It's really not. But it is true that there's at least, I think, 60 different parts. Only 8 of them are identified for us. And by the way, also notice, in a lot of time in the last 3 weeks in this chapter, there are 8 things mentioned in the interpretation that were not mentioned in the dream itself. So I actually only found 52 in the first 14 verses. Then I found 8 new ones that were in the interpretation there. Now you can go count them up the only way you like. But brethren, that's a lot of stuff, isn't it? This is, I believe, the principal reason that this chapter has been so difficult for everybody. It's been difficult for me. It's been difficult for everybody. Well, why not? You know, Rubik's Cube's only got 4 sides. Although, what is it? How many individual squares is on the side of a Rubik's Cube? Who can tell you that? It's got 6 sides, doesn't it? Oh, yeah, 6. It's really stuck in my head. Okay, so, you know, I don't know. But maybe it's that many. And that's what makes it complex. And when it is exquisite like that, with a lot of detail, and then we don't get a whole lot of interpretation, there is a whole lot of room for fantastic, wild, and irresponsible, reckless, and reprehensible commentators, like the people that came up with Left Behind and all that kind of malarkey, you know, to go and maintain anything they want. And then they get away with it because we've got a lot of parts, and they're not all explained. So, brethren, let me just solve this problem for you, okay? Here's the deal. In Daniel 7, verses 17 through 28, there is an interpretation given. You can read it yourself. And that's it. That's the interpretation. The interpretation is, the 4 beasts equals 4 kings. So in this book already, Daniel has used kings and kingdoms interchangeably. So in chapter 2, we saw the king, you know, was Nebuchadnezzar, but the kingdom is what we're talking about, and there were several more kings after Nebuchadnezzar. The 4 beasts are 4 kingdoms, but the saints will receive and possess the kingdom. Now, that's the interpretation. Almost period. But there were some identifications given. So, in 7:23, you are told, the 4th beast is a 4th kingdom, which devours, treads, and crushes the earth. That's explained in the interpretation. In verse 24, you are told, the 10 horns equal 10 kings. Then, in 7:24, you are told, the little horn, which is an 11th horn, will subdue, in the second time it's mentioned, three of these kings. Then you're told in verse 25 that the little horn blasphemes God, wages war, and overpowers the saints. Look at verse 21 as well to put those two together, but he's going to wage the war and win for a time. He's going to overpower the saints. In 7:25, we're also told that little horn will overpower the saints for time, times, and half a time. And then we are told in verse 26, the court will convenes, books are open, and it dethrones, that's a word that's not used there, but that 11th king is annihilated, destroyed forever. So that's the end of him. And then lastly, in verse 27, we are told, the saints receive an eternal kingdom, and all dominions will serve the Son of Man who is presented to the Ancient of Days. Now, brethren, that's all the interpretation I can find in Daniel 7. So, the overall, four beasts or four kingdoms, but fear not, the saints will receive it, and they'll possess the kingdom. Fourth beast is a kingdom, horns are kings, little horn's another king, tears up three, little horn blasphemes God and overpowers the saints, little horn will overpower those saints for time, time, half a time, court will sit, dethrones the 11th king, annihilates and destroys him forever, and the saints receive the eternal kingdom, and all dominions serve the Son of Man. So that's it. Class dismissed. That's all the interpretation that what? That we are given by God to Daniel and written down from all the way back in the 6th century B.C., 2,500 years ago. But brethren, that is it. That is all the interpretation that you're going to be given in the chapter by Daniel. So does that mean that there are 52 things we will never know about? No, I don't think so at all. I think the interpretation that is given, coupled with a whole lot of scripture we're going to race through in the next few minutes, will identify for you everything else there is in that vision. Or at least enough that you can know with absolute certainty what it's talking about. It was there, brethren, for a reason. It's not a mystery piled on top of an enigma. How does that old saying go? Wrapped in a... I forget how that one goes. It wasn't intended to confuse everybody. God does not give us this kind of information, so we'll never know. If there are 60 parts to this, then there's a reason that there's not 59. Okay? There's a reason. So, class dismissed. You go on home on the interpretation that's given. But did anybody have any other questions? Well, you're all squirming in your seat. I don't know about everything. Here's some of the questions that would remain. Who is the Son of Man? And what judgment is this that we're reading about in those verses? And who's the little horn? That's probably the biggest question in the whole chapter for most folks. And what three kings did the little horn subdue? And I'd like to know who the saints are. I'd like to know when that war is or has taken place against those saints. I'd like to know when then those saints were overpowered or will be, and when the saints possessed the kingdom. I'd like to know the answers to those questions, wouldn't you? Are they given in the interpretation? No, not really. But the really big one I'd like to know is, what does time, times, and half a time mean? Now, brethren, I believe that the best way that you can understand any prophecy in Scripture is to find those very prominent mileposts and benchmarks, the cornerstones, and find the big stuff that's identifiable. It produces a framework. It gives you then a structure that everything else has to fit into and be a part of. And in this case, brethren, I'll suggest to you that one of the last things that's said is what will solve our entire puzzle for us. I can figure this out. I know what it's talking about. Enormous confidence. I know what this is talking about. And I believe, brethren, that this phrase, time, times, and half the times, though it's at the end, is the key. Everything, brethren, in the interpretation of this particular passage and many others will hinge on a time reference. So, when you know, some one of these reckless expositors, you know, that believes in premillennialism, that kind of garbage gets up, you know, and they start telling you that any day now the Antichrist is coming and all the rest of that kind of stuff. If you can find a time stamp that God puts on that term Antichrist, then it eliminates premillennialism. It reveals it to be the bunch of smoke that it is. Totally wrong. Hardly a single thing in that whole scheme that's right. Time references eliminate other possibilities. So I can say this means that. But if a time stamp won't permit it, then that is wrong. And I need to go find a this that will fit the time stamp. So first and foremost, what is our obvious and most prominent time stamp? These are four kingdoms, physical or spiritual, the four. Physical. Are they just mixed up, or do they follow one after the other? Do not all these scriptures make it abundantly plain? We haven't seen 8 yet, or chapter 11, but they all make it abundantly plain. They are physical kingdoms, starting with Babylon, go right down through history, and we live on this side of it now, so we know what those kingdoms were. It's easy for us. But brethren, how many millenniums after Rome is anything discussed in this passage? Not a bit. Zero. Cal put his hand up. Zero. Cal's right. Therefore, I cannot be wrong. Now, brethren, really, it's that simple. It ends with Rome. So if you have some kind of interpretation that does not have these events taking place within that context, then your interpretation is necessarily incorrect. So what did we see in Daniel 2, in Daniel 7, and in Daniel 8? And I forgot to change these. I swiped somebody else's totally mistaken understanding. So I forgot to take those numbers off. But here's what we got. The head of gold is Babylon. The lion with the wings is what? Babylon. In the middle is Medo-Persia as a bear and about to be a goat. And now we got a ram. And then we have Greece, four-headed leopard with four wings, and the goat. And then we have Rome, which is the legs and feet, in the figure of a monster now in Daniel chapter 7. It's Rome, during which all of these events take place. Now you may have to go back and confirm that yourself in your future studies. But read your heart out. And brethren, contextually, nothing's taking place outside the existence of the Roman Empire. Not anything in this vision. So if you don't have it back there, you've missed it. You've got a mistake there. Next, since these kingdoms end with Rome, if I can figure out time, times, and half a time inside that Roman context, then we're going to be in good shape. Now get out your pencils. Here's where it really gets busy tonight. I'm halfway through the class exactly. But right now you need these verses. And it is because these verses are scattered throughout the Old and New Testaments that people are unfamiliar with them, can't remember them, don't put them together, and get all confused then in understanding Daniel 7. But if you will carefully write down what I'm going to put up on these next two slides, then you can go and look at the bigger context in each of these passages. But I'm here to tell you tonight, I know what that expression is talking about. I can't be wrong because it's the only one that has biblical foundation for it. Not some nutcase claiming you can read about it in today's newspaper, but something that was taking place during the time frame of the Roman Empire. What is time, times, and half a time? Now, brethren, there seems to be common agreement, and I'm real sure that it's correct. I'll show you why in a minute. But the time here represents a year. Times represents
2 years, and half the time makes 3.5 years. You'll see why in a minute. I'll show you verse after verse. That's ironclad. Now, by the way, back in chapter 4, we had a vision of the great tree, and it was chopped down, you know, a band was put around it, and then, it's Nebuchadnezzar, and he's going to pay for his being so arrogant, and now he's going to eat grass and grow long fingernails and toenails, and finally get his sense back and praise God, who rules in the kingdoms of men. At that time, we also had times. We had 7 times there. And so I said, well, I don't know what a time is in chapter 4. It's not defined in chapter 4. But now, here, with the verses I'm about to give you, I believe it is going to be defined for us. So, it is at least reasonable, I think a strong argument, the one Cal is promoting, that probably the times, the 7 of them, that Nebuchadnezzar was out of his mind, behaving like an animal, would be 7 years. That's highly likely. But we don't get that interpretation in Daniel 4. And I'm deriving it from some thought processes, thanks to 7 in the verses I'm about to give you. Hold up your pen or pencil if you've got it ready to write. Okay. All right, everybody. Time, times, and half a time. Daniel 11 is point number 1. And I handed out the outline, which we'll deal with in detail, 4 weeks from now, I guess it is. Okay, so this interprets what we read in Daniel 11. Come back to Daniel 11. Verse 1, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement, protection for him. Now I'll tell you the truth. Behold, 3 more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a 4th will gain far more riches than all. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he'll arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And a mighty king will arise, he'll rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he's arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the 4 points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority, which he wielded. For his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides him. Then the king of the south will grow strong along with one of his princes, and off we go. All the way down through the 45th verse, which is the last verse of this chapter. Thanks to McGiggin. Why can't I remember his first name? Jim McGiggin. Okay. Who's done some really excellent work in Daniel. His commentary, Jim McGiggin, excellent. He misses the whole boat here, but most of the time, seven, but most of the time he really gets it right. And this is all his work, not my work. It's just simply seeing that here in Daniel 11, it's not monstrous beasts, you know, and great statues and all that, but we got king of the north, king of the south. We have a very detailed history. And that is interpreted for you historically, since we live on the far side of it, on this page. Tuck it in at Daniel 11, keep it with you always. This, I think, is also certain, and most commentators accept it. So, when you get to the last verse, in 45, it says, he'll pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. And then if you look at the chart that I handed out, verse 45, it says, after 45 years as emperor, Octavian dies in Rome in 14 A.D. He'll be the longest lasting emperor of all time. They will name him Augustus, because to be august means to be great and good and wonderful. So Octavian was dubbed Augustus because he was so fabulous as a ruler. And again, brethren, we're just coming down the history from Daniel's time all the way through here to an emperor named Octavian, who was also called Augustus, who was an emperor over what country? Rome. And if he dies in 14 A.D. and he reigned for 45 years, then who was born during his reign? The Son of Man was born during his reign. Now look at chapter 12 of Daniel. In chapter 12, next verse, verse 1. At that time. Did we just leap 2,000 years and come down to today so we can read it in newspaper like your premillennialist would have you believe? No, it's at that time. At that time,
Michael the great prince who stands over the sons of your people, sons of whose people? Daniel's people. Who are Daniel's people? The Jews. Who are the people he's talking to? The Jews. Who are the people he's prophesying to? The Jews. We wrote the book down. Who's going to be reading this book for the next 500 years until the Son of Man comes? And then for the 2,000 years that brings us down today, Daniel's people are the Jews. There will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. Now, my chart, brethren, I don't have time. We'll do chapter 12. Whatever you see in the intervening verses, I'm not running from it, I'm hiding from it. I'll explain it, but can't have the time tonight. Now, skip to 6 and 7. Go to 6 and 7. One said to the man dressed in linen who was above the waters of the river, "How long will it be until the end of these wonders?" And I heard the man dressed in linen, who was above the waters of the rivers. He raised his right hand and his left toward heaven and swore to him who lives forever that it would be for a time and times and half a time. And as soon as they finished shattering the power of the holy people, what chapter does that sound like in Daniel? Waging war and overpowering, all these events will be completed. This time, times, and half a time has something to do with the terrible persecution of Daniel's people. Of Daniel's people. Because Daniel's people are the only people we're talking about here. So, in 7, he wants to know what will be the end. The end will be time, times, and half a time as soon as they finish shattering the power of the holy people. What was mentioned a couple of times and right at the end in Daniel 7. Waging war and overpowering the saints, which is another way to translate holy people, who are Daniel's people, not Gentiles, not Christians, Daniel's people, the people he's talking to. Now, everybody, next to Daniel 12, 1, 6, and 7, right now, so you go look, Matthew chapter 24. Verse 21 and verse 34. Now remember, we're still in Daniel. Daniel's been harping on four kingdoms. They've all been ending with Rome. Now in Matthew, during the period of the Roman Empire, and as Jesus is up on the Mount of Olives and giving his last instructions to the apostles, in Matthew chapter 24, that is before the crucifixion, but in Matthew chapter 24, and in verse 21, we have this. There will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. What did you just read in Daniel 12:1? You read, there will be a time of distress such as has never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who's found written in the book, will be rescued. What is Jesus saying? The same thing in verse 21 of Matthew 24. He is also saying this prior to verse 34 in Matthew 24, which says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." Would that include verse 21's great tribulation that we've never seen before? Yes, it does. What did Daniel prophesy? All the way down through Roman kings, Augustus chief among them. Now bear in mind one more thing. At that time doesn't mean Tuesday. Doesn't have to mean Tuesday. Doesn't have to mean, you know, in any given year. It's at the time of the Roman emperors. Same way it was revealed in Daniel 2, in the days of those kings. Now, it's at that time. That time is the days of those kings. What kings? Roman kings. Roman kings. And now Jesus says there's going to be a great tribulation like we've never seen before. Sounds like he's quoting Daniel. And then he says it'll happen in this generation. When who is still ruling the world physically? Roman kings at that time. So anybody gets a great tribulation you know, centuries after Rome was gone, must necessarily be incorrect. That's the Great Tribulation. Now look at Daniel chapter 12 and verse 11. Hold Matthew 24. We're coming right back. Keep your finger at Matthew. Now go to Daniel chapter 12 and skip down to verse 11. From the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there'll be 1,290 days. Brethren, I'll deal with the 1290 and I'll deal with the 1335, the next verse, when we get to chapter 12. But for right now, Daniel 11 went through the history in greater detail down to the Roman kings. And then it's continuing, but still in the days of the Roman kings. It talks about a great tribulation, which Jesus identifies must take place in the generation that he was talking to. And now we've got the abolishing of the regular sacrifice and the abomination of desolation being set up, linked to 1290 days. Just think, you know, remember that one. But remember Matthew 24. So now we're reading about an abomination of desolation. Look at Matthew chapter 24, verses 14, 15, and 16. 14, 15, and 16. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. This is one of Hal Lindsey's most egregious and ridiculous and inexplicable, maybe, you know, but also inexcusable mistakes when he says that never happened in the first century. Now, jot down, if you're in Matthew 24, write this in the margin. We're looking for a time for the end to come when the gospel's been preached in the whole world. And the same word and terminology is used in Romans chapter 1, verse 8. Write it down. Romans 1, verse 8. Next to verse 14. And also, in that same book, Romans chapter 10, verse 18, again says, the gospel's been preached in the whole world when the Roman letter is written. Also in Acts chapter 2, verses 5 through 11, you have the same thing. And again, in Colossians chapter 1, Colossians 1, in both verse 6 and in 23, you are emphatically told, using the same terminology, that by 62 AD, when Paul wrote the Colossian letter, the gospel had been preached in all the world. Well, what's coming then? The end. Then the end will come. Well, read the next verse now in Matthew 24, verse 15. That's the when. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, jump off your roof, don't go back to pack. Why? Because in Luke 21, we are told Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies, and if you don't jump and run to escape being bottled up in that city, Rome will destroy you and or take you captive. Now, wait a minute. What are we reading about? We're reading about great tribulations, and we're reading about an abomination, and we have Jesus citing Daniel's name just before verse 34 in Matthew 24, which says, I'm sending you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you'll kill and crucify, and some of them you'll scourge in your synagogues. Sounds like a great tribulation or persecution like we've never seen before. And persecute from city to city. That upon you fall all the guilt and blood shed on earth, the blood of righteous Abel, the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm reading chapter 23. I knew I had the wrong verse, but it still works. Matthew 23 leads into 24. He said the same thing twice. So write 23 down then, but I had turned the page. And what I was looking for was 24 or 34. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Until the abomination of desolation Daniel talked about. Until the tribulation that Daniel talked about. In that generation that Jesus was talking to, these things were going to happen. Okay, now, that's just this chart. I'm going to do the same thing on time, times, and half a time now, so you're continuing your chart, but I need to put it on a different page for space sake. And now, we're going to go to Revelation.
which I also understand. And it's too bad.
For a long time I didn't. And a lot of other people still don't. But Revelation chapter 12, I haven't got time to explain it all. I am an early dater. It is beyond all conceivable doubt that that book was written prior to 70 AD. It is also, in my mind, beyond all conceivable doubt that there's 18 verses in that book, 18 of them, that don't talk about first century events. And everything else does. Now, that's not a common view in the denominational world, but it's the truth. Revelation is talking about the same things Jesus was talking about, and the same things Daniel was talking about. Let me show you. Come to Revelation 12. In Revelation chapter 12. Does this sound fast to you? Oh, no. In Revelation 12, as you see on the screen, we're going to read verses 13 and 14. The whole chapter is about the woman. You know, I've taught you all this before. That woman represents the Jews, who the nation, not Mary, gives birth in the fulfillment of prophecy to their Messiah. And then she also represents the faithful Jews who will become Christians. But in Revelation 12, 13, and 14, just get this much of it. When the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. Well, the child's Jesus. Everybody knows that. There's no question. And the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she was nourished for, guess what? Time, times, and half a time. One just might get the impression that Daniel could be involved here, since that expression isn't used anywhere else in Scripture but Daniel and here. So now you come in chapter 12, look back at verse 6 now. The woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God. There she might be nourished for 1,260 days. The Jews, brethren, used a 30-day calendar. 3.5 years is, guess what, how many days? To the day. It is 1,260. It's just saying days instead of times. This, brethren, is the fulfillment of Matthew 24, where the saints see the abomination of desolation and the gospel has been preached in the whole kingdom. So what should we do? Jump and run for the Judean hills. We got to get out of town because Jerusalem's going to fall. And it did. We saw that happen. Now watch this, brethren. I cut it in the middle. Let's back up a chapter, chapter 11. Look at Revelation 11 now. In 11, we're going to read the first three verses. There was given me a measuring rod like a staff, and someone said, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship in it, and leave out the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it. It has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. What is 42 times 30? 1,260. I got a calculator to prove it. What is 42 months in years? 3.5. What is it in times? Time, times, and half a time. Next verse. And I'll grant authority to my two witnesses, and they'll prophesy for 1,260 days. Daniel's the first to give us times, times, and half a times. Then he talks about the end of a sacrifice, a daily sacrifice, and he adds 30 days to 1,260. And Josephus was an eyewitness in the first century of the cessation of the daily sacrifice. That would be most interesting in your studies of Revelation, because if you don't see that cessation of the daily sacrifice, you're going to have some problems. But what have we got in 11, 1 through 3? We've got the Gentiles trampling down the holy city for 42 months, and then it's changed to days, 1,260. Please, everybody, we're going to stay in Revelation, keep a finger there, but this time go back to Luke 21. And in Luke 21, you have the parallel passage, Luke's record of Matthew 24. So it's the exact same moment in time, same audience, same speaker, Jesus, all of that, the apostles. And in Luke, though, chapter 21, in the account that Luke records for us, in 21:20 through 24, it says this, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her..." You suppose if there's a desolation at hand, there might be an abomination of desolation? One could get that idea, since that's what Jesus called it in Matthew 24, so he also called it in Luke 21. But Matthew wrote it as abomination of desolation. Luke writes it as Jerusalem surrounded by armies is when you recognize that her desolation is at hand. "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of the city depart. Let not those who are in the country enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, in order that all things which are written may be fulfilled." If this is the end of planet Earth and the final judgment, how can you escape it by climbing a Judean hill? This is an escapable physical judgment that has to take place in this generation, when there's a persecution against the saints like we've never seen before, when the gospel's preached in all the world, and when the abomination of desolation that Daniel spoke of takes place. Yeah, there at the time, times, and half a time that the persecution and the war is going on, the saints are being overpowered, but when all that's over, the end of time, times, and half a time, you'll have the end of everything that's in Daniel, the whole book of Daniel, in fact. Now look at verse 32 in Luke 21. "Truly I say to you," what? That's a whole lot of Daniel that has to take place in this generation. Now look at Revelation chapter 12. What did I did that wrong. I messed that one up. I already did that one. It's supposed to be Revelation 13. Sorry about that. Come to 13. That's why I said I split it earlier. Started in chapter 12, went to 11, and then came back to 13. Three chapters in a row in Revelation. Now look at 13, verses 3 and 4. "I saw one of his..." Well, let's start with 1. "He stood on the sand of the seashore, where was Daniel in his dream. I saw a beast, come up out of the sea." What did Daniel see in his dream? "Having 10 horns. What did Daniel see? Now, it doesn't say 7 heads in Daniel. That's fresh and new and unique to Revelation. "On his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard." What did you read in Daniel 7? "His feet were like those of a..." Which you read about in Daniel 7, a bear. "And his mouth was like the mouth of," guess what? "A lion. The dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority." Now in Revelation 13, you've got all four beasts. And note that in Daniel 7, those four beasts, they came up in order from Daniel's viewpoint of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. But Revelation is written during the time of Rome. So now when you see a single beast with all of these component parts put together in one tremendous monster, you also get them in reverse order. You get the monster first. Then you go back to see Greece, Medo-Persia, and Babylon. Okay, so that's 13, 3, and 4. "They worshiped the dragon, gave his authority, who's like him." Now skip down in Revelation to verse 7. "It was given to him to make war with the saints." What did you read in Daniel 7? "And overcome them." What did you read in Daniel 7? "And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him." What does that sound like? Daniel 7. So brethren, what are we looking at? Do you suppose it's just a coincidence that the Roman siege of Israel and Jerusalem was 3.5 years, which makes it time, times, and half a time? Or in months, how long was it? 42. And in days, how long did it last?
1260. Was it not the greatest persecution of the Jewish nation that they would ever see? Were there remnants and pieces that came out of previous times? They get some of them out of Egypt. They get some of them out of Assyria and some out of Babylon. Did they get any out of this? All the genealogical records are destroyed, and that is the end of who as a race and a people? The Jews. Was the war waged? Were they overpowered? They were annihilated. And then, Christians had fled the city. Jews, almost every one of them, the woman went into the wilderness for 1,260 days. And then when that was over, brethren, who are the people of God? It's not the Jews. It's the Christians now. But all the persecution, we're on Daniel's what? Daniel's people. Were the Jews still a nation when the abomination of desolation came in that generation? Yeah, but not after. Was there persecution such the world's never seen? Yeah. On the saints. Now, brethren, here's the big deal. The saints are not Christians. Sure, saints are Christians in the New Testament, but what book are we reading? From Daniel's viewpoint, looking at four successive kingdoms, and then his people are going to be persecuted, what people are they? They're Jews, brethren. And were the Jews God's saints, his holy people? Why, you betcha. So now, we're going to hurry, and I'm going to go over, but you know, fear not, you've seen that done before. Who is the Son of Man in Daniel 7? Well, it's Jesus. Everybody knows that. I mean, there's no doubt about it. All right? So these are all the questions I skipped over earlier. What judgment is this? Is it the end of the world? No. It's the end of the Jews. Now look at Luke 19. I've got to run over. If you have to leave, one already has, and I never take offense. So if you need to leave, you know, leave. But I've got to have a few more minutes here. So now look at Luke 19. It's a very long passage, but it's just profoundly important, brethren. Look what Jesus said two chapters before all these things will take place in this generation. Look at Luke 19, verse 11. While they were listening to these things, he went on to tell a parable because he was near Jerusalem and they supposed that the kingdom of God was going to appear immediately. What's that tell you about the kingdom of God? Is it going to appear immediately? No. But we are late in Jesus' life, and in the chronology, the kingdom would be appearing in a couple of months. We just start thinking about when the kingdom is possessed and received. Here, the kingdom of God is not going to appear immediately, and we're late in Luke in Jesus' life. So in 12 he said, a certain nobleman went to a distant country. And the nobleman went, for what purpose there in verse 12, brethren? He went to receive a kingdom for himself. It was for himself. Anybody else involved at that point when he goes away? No. He went away to receive the kingdom. And the Son of Man came up through the clouds and was presented to the Ancient of Days. For what purpose, brethren? To receive a kingdom. When did that happen? I believe it happened in the grave. I believe that when he died, he presented his blood before our God. And then he came back from the dead. And what's the last thing he said in Matthew? All authority in heaven and on earth has what? It has been given to me. Okay? Check. Now read on. And return. In verse 12. And return. He called 10 of his slaves. He gave him 10 minas. And he said, do business with this until I come back. You suppose 3 days? I don't. But his citizens hated him. Sent a delegation after him saying, we don't want this man to reign over us. It came about that when he returned after receiving the kingdom, he ordered that these slaves to whom he had given the money be called to him in order that he might know what business they had done. first appeared saying, Master, your means made 10 minutes more. I said, well done, good slave, because you've been faithful in a very little thing, be in authority over 10 cities. Second came saying, your mina master's made 5. He said, you're the over 5. Another came, Master, behold your mina. I put away in a handkerchief. I was afraid. You're an exacting man. Take up what you didn't lay down. Reap what you don't sow. By your own words, I'll judge you, you worthless slave. Did you know that I, and at this point, who's the I? The I is the, he's the king. Come back from receiving all power and authority and dominion. Then I'm an exacting man. Why I didn't lay down, reading what I didn't sow. Why did you put the money in the bank? Having come, I've collected it with interest. He said to the bystanders, take the mina away from him. Give it to the one who has the 10. Master, he has 10 minas already. Fine, give me more then. But I tell you that to everyone who has shall more be given. From the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. But these enemies of mine, who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slay them in my presence. Why did he say these things, brethren, in verse 28? Where was he going? What are they thinking? Kingdom is not coming immediately. But when it does, people die. Everyone that will not let me rule over them. Every one of my people who will not accept me as a king. I'm going away to get that kingdom. But when I come back, it'll be the day of reckoning on those who would not accept me as their king. Now, with the abomination of desolation, everything we read in Revelation, Daniel all the way through, this generation, this generation, this generation, what time do you think the Lord came back in judgment? Slay them who will not have me rule over them. Brethren, it's the 70 AD that Jesus was talking about in Matthew 24 and in Luke 21, two chapters later. Who is the little horn? It is absolutely certain that that is Vespasian. Who was the Roman general sent into Palestine to start the war that would last for 42 months, 1260 days, times and half time, 3.5 years. Who had all authority over the Jews and all of Israel? Vespasian. And then, 68, Nero commits suicide, about a year goes by, and then Vespasian leaves the war in Titus, his son's care, so he can go back to Rome to become what? The emperor of Rome. Does he not still have authority over Jerusalem? Those 42 months, they're Vespasian or nobody. They're Vespasian, and they can't be anybody else. Here's why. Now, Brad, this is a chart I know you can't probably see. I did an enormous amount of work back in 93 when I was working on Revelation for a class that had 50 people in it. But this chart I developed in by just going to uninspired literature to get the Roman emperors. Now look, Josephus in Antiquities says Julius Caesar is the first emperor. That's a contemporary witness. You want to start counting emperors, who do you start with? The one that the Jews said was the first. Suetonius, who is not a Jew, he's a Roman, he starts counting with Julius. It's about time we started counting with Julius. Okay? Because that's the way they did in the first century. Now, after Julius, he himself was a part with, after Julius is killed, Augustus, Mark Antony, and Marcus Lepidus, from 43 to 31 B.C., form a triumvirate. There was a previous triumvirate, but it wasn't legal. This is the only legal triumvirate. If you're going to start counting with Caesar, governments, kings, rulers, you have to have the triumvirate. Because it's from 43 to 31 B.C. It lasted for 10 years. And Augustus is a part of it. That's number two. Horns. Number three is Augustus. Well, he uproots the other two guys, so it's not the uprooting we're coming to. He gets rid of the other two, shenanigans, and then death. and becomes sole king. Then there's Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero. Everybody knows about those guys. We have the year of three kings, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, in 68 and 69. And number 11, by this reckoning, is who? 10 kings in succession in the days of those kings, starting with Julius and ending with Vespasian, who is the only man in history that can match time times and half a time, 42 months, 1260 days, 3.5 years. It's him. And by the way, when these guys were fighting it out, the first one gets murdered, the second one commits suicide, the third one's also murdered, and Vespasian comes back right in here. And he has to work with their followers. He's uprooting those guys who were all fighting for it. I know some of them are dead, but their followers were still trying to gain power. That's how the three were uprooted. Is that Galba, Otho, and Vitellius didn't last, none of them, more than 8 months. And then Vespasian came back and eradicated that problem, all that were left over. It's Vespasian, brethren, beyond all doubt. What three kings did the little horn subdue? Well, he subdues them in the form of their followers, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. Who are the saints? The Jews. Daniel's people, the saints, not Christians. You're skipping over everybody Daniel was talking to when you do that. When is there a war against those saints? When they rebel against Rome, 66 to 70 AD. When are those saints overpowered, annihilated, and eradicated themselves? In the fall of Jerusalem, September of 70 AD. When do the saints possess the kingdom, brethren? With no contenders. When does the king come back and say, slay them that will not have me as a king? 70 AD. That's when the saints possess the kingdom. Now, they're in the kingdom. They're having all kinds of problems. The Jews are persecuting them, too. And then Rome takes away the persecutors that killed the Messiah. Takes away all the first persecutors for decades of the Christians. And now what the saints have, in the eyes of God and man, is there anybody else who can lay claim to being Yahweh's people? Nobody. But Christians now, because the other saints had been overpowered. When the judgment was passed in their favor, it was passed in favor of the ones who would accept their king from those people. So they possessed the kingdom in 70 AD. Thank you. There's the extra time. Now, brethren, I can defend every other word in Daniel 7. Try me. And yet tonight, lay it out. I want to do it all in one piece. But there it is. That is what Daniel 7 is talking about. Because that time, times, and half a times will absolutely not permit any other interpretation. Nor will the persecution, the overpowering, the 10 kings, the 11th horn, nothing else in history fits. But what Jesus spent so much time talking about.